So he got out of prison and reoffended, went back for a longer time. And when he got out again, I was invited to his 30th birthday party. So I was all excited about that. And
now wait, now how he spent most of his 20s in prison.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Most of his adult life, he was in prison.
How does he go from spending years in incarceration to inviting a cop to his birthday party? Welcome to Hey Chaplain. My name is Jared Altick, and I'm a chaplain with the police department. I make this podcast so that cops can hear encouragement from other cops. I know that not every cop will go have a cup of coffee with their chaplain, but it's my mission to bring encouragement and wisdom to police officers all around the world. On this podcast, you'll hear from detectives and dispatchers, U.S. Marshals and county sheriffs, and also the occasional retired SWAT team sniper. From the LAPD to Scotland Yard, the guests on Hey Chaplain are giving you the wisdom gleaned from their experience so that you don't have to do everything the hard way. When I talk to fans of the show, one of the top, if not the very top name mentioned, is Tim Agerbrotten. And if they can't remember that last name, they say, it's that police chief who had that terrible year and he also plays guitar. That guy. So, back due to popular demand, is Tim Agerbrotten, with all kinds of great stories to tell. In my most recent conversation with the off-duty chief, I zeroed in on two stories that I found especially interesting, both about cops leaping to conclusions about people. The bigger one we'll cover this week. The smaller one, I'll drop into a part two episode next week. Here's Tim Agerbrotten. Hello, Tim. How are you today?
Jared, my brother, I am outstanding. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
I'm doing great. I'm so glad that I could get you today to chat with you on a snowy day. I wanted to talk to you today because there's just a lot of experience that you have as a police officer, as a police chief, that you bring to the table. And I enjoy talking to you and I enjoy picking your brain. One of the common problems that we have in law enforcement is the cynicism that begins to build. The job encourages it. It encourages an officer to see kind of the worst and always be on the lookout for the worst of human behavior. And you start to feel like you can pigeonhole everybody.
Yeah.
And you get into a us versus them kind of mentality.
Very much.
And that's something that a lot of officers routinely struggle with and have to fight back and, you know, push back against.
Yeah.
I assume that's been your experience too.
Yeah, you nailed it. I mean, it's a requirement of the job because when you're on a traffic stop at 3 a.m., you can't, you know, assume that this person's just going out to get milk and eggs. You know, I mean, have to have that, a little bit of that us versus them. And certainly if you're in riot gear and you're standing a line and there's people spitting on you. I mean, it's directly an us versus them. But the challenge is how do you balance that? Like when you go home, a lot of people will say, well, you just wipe your feet at the door and you walk in and you leave your work at work. Well, I mean, it's really hard to do that. And then when you go to church or you go to your kids' PTA meeting or whatever, their school function, and you're seeing people that you just got done dealing with, you know, and it's like, yeah, it's hard to find that balance, and we can become very cynical and get that crust built around us. And a lot of times people will come into our lives that kind of start to chip away at that crust, and they, we have to be open to recognizing that too, that not everybody's out to cause us harm. Not everybody, even if they are, if they're in a situation where they are screwing up by the numbers, it doesn't automatically put them into that bad guy category for the rest of their life. I mean, there's redemption out there. People change. We change, you know, and I am not the same person I was even 5 years ago. And
But it's hard. It's hard to remember that, though. And a lot of cops do a really good job, maybe even to excess, of compartmentalizing. And so I'm at work. I'm in work mode. And I don't even know as though they automatically look at everybody as dangerous, but they do look at people as being extra work.
Yeah.
And it's like, so you're pulling somebody over at 3 a.m, even if they are going to go get groceries, why? Why are you getting groceries at 3 a.m?
Yeah.
Why can't you just be a normal person? Why are you out here? Why do you have a broken taillight? Why did you run the stop sign? Why? And so there's a frustration and a judgment that occurs, and the judgment may or may not be correct, but it's a pretty natural, you know, like, why are you making things harder for me? Why are you being difficult? And you then label that person, especially if you're in a smaller town and you might see them routinely, you label that person as, oh, this is the person who's extra work, even if they're not right now, but they were, three nights ago or 3 years ago. And so you begin to label people, and you just kind of figure, well, I know what they're like, and that's just what I expected.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of that kind of cynicism when I talk to police officers.
Yeah. And again, some of that is fine. I mean, in moderation, you need that survival, where you're reading people, and we get really good at reading people. Mm-hmm. Body language.
Yep. Not saying the judgment's wrong.
Exactly.
It may be factually correct.
Right.
Right.
We narrow our world down into cops and bad guys, and even the night shift cops, part of the bad guys might be administration, and it's us versus them. And it really is. And it's, or the day shift. What does the day shift do? They're sitting around playing.
They don't do anything.
They don't do anything. Right.
They got it so easy.
Yeah. And then when the day shift comes in and they realize that there was a burglary, it's like, well, what the hell was a night shift doing?
Right, right.
They're at Perkins sitting there eating their donuts and drinking coffee and
and not cleaning out the car.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we fall into that trap where everything is adversarial. I mean, there are people though that can, if we allow them, to profoundly affect our lives in a positive way. And even though we're, like you said, we're dealing with them and they're more work, but I think that work can pay off. And in the 28 years, I may have had half a dozen or 10 people that came back to me and said, thank you for what you did. You rode me hard and by golly, I needed that. And you made an impact. And so that's just a smattering of people out of the thousands of people we come in contact with. But we need to remember, though, that we are making a difference. Even if it's the same drunk person that you're picking up off the ground, their value is so low in your own mind. But the reality is that that's another human being, that if you keep picking that person up, maybe, just maybe, that next time you pick them up, maybe something sticks. Maybe you're just applying another puzzle piece to their life. And this person showed me compassion. I've never had that before. And all the other cops tase me or pepper spray me or whatever. And this guy was nice to me, and maybe that's something that sticks.
Well, Tim, tell me a story. Give me an example of what you're talking about.
I was deep into that us versus them mindset early on in my career. I came to Detroit Lakes, Minnesota as a cop. So people didn't know me as little Timmy Agerbratton from down the street. And about 2 years into my career, my sergeant and my captain recognized I was kind of a knuckle-dragging thug. And so they said, you're going to go to DARE school. I said, I'm not going to DARE school. I didn't want to be a teacher. I want to be a cop. And so they ordered me to go to DARE school, and it was amazing. I loved it.
DARE is the program for what?
Drug Abuse Resistance Education. At that time, it was a 14-week program.
Okay.
So I went in and talked to sixth graders about drug abuse and attitudes. And so a 14-week curriculum and for an hour a week. And it was amazing. It was a game changer. And early on in that, I had started to see these young people, instead of them running away from me and me having to chase them down, and thinking that all these 12 and 13 and 14-year-old kids were a bunch of pukes, that by golly, they're almost all rock stars. They're really good kids. But I was early into my teaching dare, and I was hanging out at the middle school, and some kids came up, said, "Mr. Agerbrotten, did you know somebody's peeing on your police car?" And I was like, what? I was like, "What now?" And so I ran over to my squad car, and I could see the pee dripping from the passenger side door. And I'm like, "Son of a gun!" And of course, there was nobody around. And I went back to the kids, and they described this guy. And I was like, I knew right away who it was. And 12-year-old kid, and I dealt with him a few times, and tall kid. And so I went to his house, and he was there, and I asked him if he wanted to go for a ride, and he got into my car, and we're going for a ride, and I'm giving him the come to Jesus meeting, you know, like, "Hey, buddy, if you're going to continue going down this path and blah, 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 and stop doing this, you know, whatever you're doing, just knock it off." And so I met this kid at 12 years old, and I liked him right out of the chute. You know, he was rough, and he had a chip on his shoulder. I had no clue what the chip was. Tall Native American kid, and went to some of his track meets in junior high, and really got to know him, and kind of took him under my wing as a mentor. And then he started getting into a lot of trouble and started getting into some gang activity, and we arrested him a bunch of times, and he did a drive-by where he flashed a shotgun, and he went to prison for a while. And so he was progressively getting tougher and tougher and tougher. And so he'd go to prison for a while, and then he'd come out and be even more tough than when he went in. And he was just like...
And what age coming out of prison?
Like starting in his 19, 20, you know, like when he's an adult, and he's just a lot of scrapes. And then he would, in prison, you know, he learned that if somebody disrespected him, he's huge. He was like 6'4" at that point, and a big kid. And so in prison, if somebody disrespected him, he'd just pound knots on their head. I mean, that's what you did. And then when he got out of prison, if somebody disrespected him, he would, you know, and he was involved with alcohol and drugs and gang stuff. But every time that he would get out of prison, I'd encounter him again, and I'd be like, "Hey, buddy, how you doing?" You know, and we had this mutual respect for each other, even though I was doing the law enforcement side and he was doing the I'm going to go to jail side, you know. But I always had a soft spot in my heart for the kid. I have no idea why. I mean, he just felt like somebody that I needed to believe in. So then he did like a 5-year stint and got out of prison. And now we have some new officers that didn't know him. And I said, "Hey, guys," just call him James. And I said, "James is getting out of prison. And just so you know, deal with him, but don't get like all macho cop with him, because he's going to fight, you know." And I said, "But certainly if he screws up, if he does something, handle it. But don't try to like be macho on him." So he got out of prison and reoffended, went back for a longer time. And when he got out again, I was invited to his 30th birthday party. So I was all excited about that. And
how he spent most of his 20s in prison.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Most of his adult life, he was in prison.
How does he go from spending years in incarceration to inviting a cop to his birthday party?
Well, it was...
It seems like a strange invite list when the fourth name down on the list is Officer Aaron.
Yeah, it was a very strange invite, but it came about because right before he went back to prison, he had done an armed robbery, and I was... I knew who it was. They described him. He is, you know, 6'4", Native American with a long ponytail, So I knew, and I waited for him, and he came driving up with a bunch of his buddies, and I just pulled my squad car up. I hit my spotlight. I got out of my car, and I said, "James, walk toward the light." And he started walking towards me, and he turned around, and he bolted. And 6'4", so I'm running through this crowd of his buddies, you know, and yelling at him. And I could see him reaching his waistband in the back of his pants, and I could see him throw something, and he fell a couple times and he got up and he was running. So I caught up to him and I was probably about 6 feet behind him and off to his right. And I could see him reaching at his chest and he pulled back and I could see the butt of a pistol. And I drew my sidearm and I'm like, don't do it, James, don't do it, James. And I'm like screaming the whole time. And it's probably 3 o'clock in the morning. And then he fell again and he got up and he gave one more tug on this butt of the gun. And I could see that it was stuck. And at that time, our department, we only had 14 cops. And so our department, we only had 2 tasers for everybody. And so when we came on shift, we'd grab a fanny pack with a taser in it. They were still pretty new and they were brand new to us. And so I could see that this gun or whatever it was stuck. And he got up and started running again. I holstered my Glock and I pulled out this taser. I said, stop or I'll poop, you know, and there was no warning really. I mean, it was just like, and I lit him up like a 6'4" Christmas tree and it, one probe hit right above his belt and the other probe hit his ankle and he went down hard and then he flipped over. And then when he flipped over on his back, I could see it was a 44 Magnum with the 8.5-inch barrel. So like a Dirty Harry pistol. Yeah. And it was strapped on his chest.
With him.
Huge, yeah. And it was, he had made a little shoulder holster thing out of bandanas and stuff. And that's what it was stuck on. And so I just reached down and I grabbed the gun and I snapped his little holster thing. But it was still attached to him. And so it was kind of laying by his side. And I just stood on the gun. The probes from the taser were still attached to him. And then with his right hand, he started reaching for the gun. And I'm like, what are you doing? You know, I'm going to light you up again, you know? And then he just kind of relaxed, like, okay, the gig's up. And I could hear sirens coming and my backup was on the way. I had no clue where we were at. We ran through like, I don't know, half a dozen yards. And I'm like looking around and they're on the radio. Where are you at, Tim? Where are you at? And James is laying there and he looks up at me and says, Tim, just tell him you're on East Central. I said, oh, I appreciate that. You know, and so I got on the radio and said, I'm on East Central. And they came and we took him into custody. So
at the time of this foot pursuit, he was already friendly with you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had known each other since he was 12. And I think when he went in at that time, he was probably 25.
Okay, so over a decade,
yeah,
and he's friendly enough to kid around with you,
right?
But he was also trying to pull a gun on you,
right? Exactly, and the other thing that he had thrown was a 9mm, so he had 2 guns on him.
Oh, good grief!
And we found a third one that was stolen. All 3 of them were stolen, but we found a third one in his car afterwards. But so up in the jail, you know, and he and I were on a first name basis. We got along really well, and I went up to the jail and he said, "Tim, I wasn't going to hurt you." I'm like, how would I know that, James?
You
know,
you almost shot him.
Yeah, it was the closest in 28 years I ever came. If I hadn't had the taser as an option, I would have shot him. And I told him that. And he goes, I wasn't going to hurt you. And I said, well, you know, it's a little late now, but I mean, how was I to know that? And I'm just, I was so thankful. His mom is a friend of mine.
Well, that was going to be one of my other questions is if you had other familial connections, like a mother, you know, because I wondered how, especially as he goes away for years, how does he maintain a connection to you from his childhood?
Right.
And part of that is that you knew his mom and maybe know other family too, or.
Yep. His little brother was my son's age
there were multiple connections.
Yeah. And we're a town of like 9,000 people. So it's not a huge metropolis and we get to know each other and stuff like that. But, you know, and I just said, dude, you have no clue how close you got to being shot, you know, and it would have been justified and all of that. I would have passed all of those tests, but still it wasn't the first or last time that I pulled a gun on somebody and, you know, but it would have sucked up one side and down the other for me personally.
Yeah.
And it would have been horrible for him and his family. And so I'm so glad that we had these tasers. The next day I went into the chief's office. I laid the taser down. I said, boss, this taser just saved us lawsuits, saved us, you know, me shooting this kid. And And then we ordered tasers for everybody. So then he went to prison for a long time, got out, and that's when
fast forward to the birthday party.
Birthday party, yeah. So I'm at this birthday party. I'm pretty sure I was the only white guy there, and everybody else Native American, and I'm waiting, and it was a surprise birthday party. And he comes in and he's like, "Dog," you know, and he's it's hilarious. And he was like, "Hey, y'all, you know that car that I pissed on, that was his car, you know?" And I'm like, "Yeah, James, that was you that peed on my car." And he goes, hey, you know that cop that tased me 3 times? That's him. I'm like, James, come on now. That was one and done, baby. And you cried like a little girl. And we were able to rip each other, you know, pretty good. And he's like, "No, man, you kept lighting me up." I said, "Nope, it was one and done. It was a 5-second ride, buddy." And then unfortunately, you know, he did okay for a while. He was a firefighter out in North Dakota somewhere, like wildfires, and doing okay for a while. And then he just got hooked up again and went back to jail, went back to prison. And I corresponded with him almost weekly, and I went and visited him in jail. I gave him a challenge coin. I don't know if he got it. Like through all the jail transfers.
No, stop again. you've got this kid that has been pretty much just trouble.
Yeah.
And he's spent most of his adult life in prison so far.
Yeah.
Why are you writing to him every week? Is that a good use of your time?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it is. And but I honestly, Jared, I don't know what has drawn me to this guy. But he spent his 40th birthday in prison. He's out now. On his 41st birthday, we went and had coffee and lunch together, and he's doing great. He's like a supervisor for a dock and lift, you know, thing. And so he's doing really well.
But in 20 years of you investing in this young man,
yeah,
where you felt a connection, you felt compelled to reach out to him,
yep,
that's fine. But surely somebody else, your wife, your coworkers, somebody else noticed you investing in this guy and said, Tim, this isn't going anywhere.
Yeah. Nobody ever said that. Because I was so adamant about this kid for whatever reason, probably because I knew him since he was 12, and he just, there's just something about him, and he has this energy, and he's likable, and, you know, so it really showed me that, and I never looked at it as me investing in anybody. You know, it was just he got involved with a group called Prison Fellowship. And so he found faith, and it was really hard. And he would be honest with me about his gang affiliation, you know, and how the Native gangs that he was part of, how they would treat him if they knew that he was a Christian, you know, and wanting to pursue that faith. So there was just this internal battle going on too, and external. I just kept hanging in there with him and kept sending him letters, and we were very open with each other, and he was open with me. And to the listeners of your podcast, I just want to remind you that, yeah, you're dealing with these people over and over and over and over again, and you feel like you're beating your head against the wall. But just know that every time you're dealing with somebody, that's another piece to that person's puzzle, whether it's incarceration or getting lit up with 50,000 volts of love on their taser or whatever it is that's happening, it's another piece to their personal puzzle. And sometime, someday, maybe something else is going to be that final piece for that person. And all of those puzzle pieces that you help place as a police officer, as a first responder, you can make a difference into that person. And nobody's irredeemable. Nobody's trash. And we know we have all kinds of names for the people we're dealing with all the time, and they're not friendly names. They're not. And it's easier for us to call them a dirtbag or something worse. It's easier to say that and just say than to call them James. Because when you put the actual name, and when you get to know, like, they have a history, they have a future, that's where we can really start to make a difference. And, you know, I never got into this relationship with James with the idea that well, this is me. I'm going to save him. I screw up every single day. I have screwed up by the numbers. And so most of it is like, well, who am I? You know, who am I to cast judgment on this kid, you know, by what he's doing? Yeah, I'm going to stop him from hurting somebody. I'm going to do my job, but I'm not going to take it so far and just classify this kid as worthless. And he's a dirtbag and he is not worth anything else, because he is. And they all are, you know, but
yeah.
But it's really hard to find that mindset, especially in the bigger cities where I understand there your call after call after call after call. And it sucks you down, it drags you in. And it's just like one of those never ending pieces that just drive you down into the dirt.
So part of what I think I was hearing is that there was a personal humility in you,
mm-hmm.
that you didn't see yourself as above, and you didn't see people like James as other.
Right.
You were like, well, hey, I mean, I mess up too. And
right.
So that personal humility seems to have helped drive your investment in him.
Yeah.
But where do you get the fuel for that? I mean, in the course of a law enforcement career, there's going to be seasons of depression,
mm-hmm.
maybe seasons of alcohol abuse, mm-hmm. seasons of cynicism, mm-hmm. and just being demoralized. You're just grumpy and tired and frustrated. When you're in a season like that, where on earth do you get the energy to give someone the benefit of the doubt and have a humble attitude and I'm going to go invest in this young man? Where does that come from?
For me, it came from my family and my church and my faith, okay. And the mistakes I made and being honest with myself, like, okay, well, you know, I'm not a poster child for anything. And the more active I became in my community, whether it was like Cub Scouts and, you know, so that was a big part of it. Living in my community, I knew that I wanted to do things outside of law enforcement. Music has been huge. So I've been doing entertaining and music for ever. And mm-hmm. and so that was, so my identity in the community wasn't just Tim the cop. It was, oh, there's Tim the Cub Scout leader, there's Tim the choir singer guy, there's Tim the one man band entertainer, and Tim the canine cop, you know, and all those different things. And I think that's a slippery slope when we start identifying all the time as a police officer. And that's
because when you started, they only knew you as a cop.
Correct.
But over time, they learned other sides of you.
Exactly.
And that created accountability, you're saying?
Accountability, and then just more on my own part that, okay, these are people I respect and people I'm still going to do my job, but I don't
you're
need
to. You're engaging them in different ways.
Yeah, I don't need to be that okay. knuckle-dragging thug that is just like so adversarial all the time. And
yeah, well, and that's what I would want out of a show like what I produce here, is that a cop would be able to routinely listen to other cops, give some encouragement,
right,
and maybe push back against some of that natural cynicism that emerges.
Yeah.
And to kind of check that bad attitude that is making you unhappy and is a danger to you and people around you. It's not what we want for you.
Right.
And so if I can put something in front of you that'll, you know, help bump you in the other direction. It's not a cure all. It's not right. going to fix everything, but listening to other cops express the things that you've expressed and seeing people like you, Tim, where you're in a much better season. You went through some tough times,
mm-hmm.
but now you're in a different part of your life. And this chapter is happy and productive,
yeah.
and it's good.
Yeah.
And so that's something that could be in every cop's future, but a lot of them just don't feel like that'll ever come.
Right.
And they're so down and demoralized right now. It's tough to imagine it.
Oh yeah. Brothers and sisters, please hang in there. Cause even if you're dealing with a lot of calls every single night and you're getting spit on and called names, and I get all that. I truly do. But that is a small piece of your life. It's a small piece of the citizens that you're representing and that you're keeping safe. The vast majority, and that's just it. We we focus so much on the negative because that's our job too. As first responders, we have to focus on what's, you know, what this could happen. And I get
you're
that.
You're there to deal with the negative.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I understand that, but do something outside of law enforcement too, or even in law enforcement when you're talking to somebody at the grocery store and you're grabbing, you know, a coffee or something or whatever, and you're in uniform, recognize the times that people come up to you and say, thank you, officer, you know, and thank you for what you do. And because that's, if you start counting, it's going to be 1,000 times more than, you know, and I don't care what neighborhood you work in. There are little kids out there that are looking at that uniform of yours and the shiny boots, and they're wondering what all that stuff is on your belt and your vest. And the little kid out there is dreaming, this is what I want to do when I grow up. I want to help people like this officer is. And I remember being 6 years old and seeing my cousin or my mom's cousin in a Washington State police outfit, you know, and with the smoky bear hat, you know, and everything. And I thought, dude, that is what I want to do. I don't even know what he is. And it's an admirable career. It's an amazing career. We get to do things that very few people get an opportunity to do. And the flip side of that is you experience things you hope nobody else has to experience. But there are ways, healthy ways to vent that and to, because you have to deal with that. I mean, the stuff you're seeing, you cannot make up. And our brains weren't meant to process all that.
Tim, I appreciate you so much. Thank you for sharing. And thank you for your service and what you've done over the years.
Yeah, thank you, Jared. I mean, that this podcast is reaching people you may, you know, never hear about. Like the Jameses and the lives that come forward and say, hey, you made a difference. And how many people you're able to reach. And this lasts on and on and on and on. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. I love talking to Tim, especially at this stage of his life, because he's gone through a journey that a lot of cops are going through to combat cynicism. And one of the things that I do to combat cynicism is that I go looking for stories like this, not necessarily just for the podcast, but examples anywhere I can find them of officers doing random acts of kindness, and especially examples of generosity and kindness toward people who don't deserve it. Cops do this all the time, but I know that when I'm feeling worn out and negative, I need to see it to be reminded that not everything in this ugly and broken world is as bad as it feels sometimes. In the much longer version of the conversation that I had with Tim, he also gave me a great second story that I'll share with you next week. Here's a little preview.
And as the sun started coming up, we could see people walking on the beach, and I could see this black clump kind of on the beach. And I didn't know if it was like a garbage bag or what it was. And
right, you're looking down on the beach, and you're in threat assessment mode.
I made a comment to my son that was with me, and I just started walking down there. And as I got closer, I could see that it was a man. It was a person laying there.
Like, that's where he slept?
I don't know if he slept there all night or what, but, you know, no shoes, and he had a jacket he was using as a blanket, and there was a guitar laying next to him.
If you would like to help the show be more successful, one thing you can do is find it on social media, especially Facebook and Instagram. A lot of cops found the show when it was shared with them on social media, they had listened to an episode, and then they were hooked. So one of the best ways to help the show is to go share those posts, to go spread the news about Hey Chaplain, so that more cops can find the show and be encouraged. The views expressed here are the personal views of the host and our guest and do not necessarily represent the views of any law enforcement agency or its components. If you like this episode, please share it with a cop or someone who loves a cop. Thank you for listening to Hey Chaplain. And as always, pray for peace in our city.